Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's episode focuses on the health risks associated with changing diets around the globe. As populations throughout the world gravitate toward large cities and join the middle class, their lifestyles shift. One of these shifts involves diet, and changes in diet can contribute to such illnesses as obesity and diabetes. During this program, we'll hear about this new health danger and ways to prevent an epidemic. Speakers include Jason Beaubien of National Public Radio, Bruce Lee of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and Geeta Singh, assistant professor at Tufts University. The conversation is moderated by Christopher Gardner of Stanford Prevention Research Center. This program was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs Council audience as part of our annual conference, World Affairs 2015. And now to our moderator.
We have a fabulous topic for you today, food. Oh my God, we are all going to die soon unless we figure this out. And so we are going to present this enormous challenge to you that we should not die earlier than need be as the whole globe moves towards urbanization. And as we move towards urbanization and population explosion, how are we going to feed all these people in a sustainable way? Are we going to have new food practices? What if everybody tries to copy the American diet? I'm not sure that can be supported in any shape or way. So major changes are going to have to happen. In what way are we going to be able to respond to all these global challenges that are going on? So I would like to start with Geeta Singh because she has access to this incredible data set. So at Tufts University, working with one of my colleagues, Derry Mosafarian, they have been collecting data on hundreds of countries, mortality, morbidity data, lots of food data. I bet the quality of the data varies from country to country. It's just been an incredible process piecing all of these data together. And when enormous advantages, when we just look in the U.S., because I'm a U.S. Stanford feed-em and bleed-em scientist. I feed people soy and garlic and things like that. And the folks who come to see me have a very narrow range of dietary options compared to globally when they eat very, very different things. So by pooling all these data, she can see dramatic differences in countries and what we've got going on right now with this population explosion and urbanization is transitions. So a really fascinating thing that Geeta gets to look at is nutrition transitions. So many countries in the world don't have enough food to eat, and then the system changes, and they do. And there's a really important flip going on right now in this nutrition transition is as soon as they get enough food to eat, some of them flip right into excess, hyperpalatable, ultra-processed food, and we're seeing rates of diabetes soar when they never should be soaring. We should just be getting better, safer, more affordable, better access to food. And we're having enormous problems with this nutrition transition. So she's done studies on sugar-sweetened beverages and different kinds of beverages. So Geeta, can you give us perspectives on what is happening in the world today?
Sure. Thank you, Christopher. So over the past 20 or 30 years, we've seen a dramatic change in the way that people eat around the world. This is in large part due to the increased availability of ultra-processed foods and highly refined carbohydrates, sugar-sweetened beverages, increased consumption of vegetable oils. And these transitions are especially pronounced in low- and middle-income countries, which, as Christopher mentioned, are undergoing very rapid urbanization and also economic development. For example, if you consider the way that people have been eating healthy foods, so things like fruits, vegetables, whole grains, nuts, and seeds, if you look at wealthy countries, actually over the past 20 years, diet has improved in terms of consumption of healthy foods. But if you look at consumption of unhealthy foods like ultra-processed foods and refined carbohydrates, consumption of those types of foods has dramatically increased both in high-income countries, but also in low- and middle-income countries. And due to this dramatic increase, we see very rapid and sudden changes and increases in rates of cardiovascular disease and diabetes, while we still see micronutrient deficiencies in many of the same populations. Currently, about 80% of cardiovascular disease actually occurs in low and middle income countries. And, you know, within countries, there are also very interesting and somewhat alarming patterns. For example, if you look at burdens of disease related to sugar-sweetened beverage consumption in Mexico, about 1 in 3 diabetes deaths in younger men in Mexico is attributable to sugar-sweetened beverage consumption. And the similar number in the U.S. in younger men is 1 in 10 diabetes deaths can be attributable to sugar-sweetened beverage consumption. Globally, probably close to 200,000 deaths are attributable to sugar-sweetened beverage consumption. Over 2 million deaths globally are attributable to excess intake of sodium. So these transitions that we're seeing are really kind of disparate across the income gradient, both at the country level and within countries. So I think this is kind of an issue of major concern. And the kind of interventions that we need to deal with these need to be really targeted towards population-specific problems as opposed to very global interventions.
So can I ask you to expand and give me any of the really stunning examples you might see? What's a best and a worst case scenario? For example, we have all kinds of problems with sugar-sweetened beverages in the U.S. Can't get a dang soda tax passed anywhere except Berkeley across the bay. Finally did that. Mexico did it for the entire country. Mexico drinking more sugar-sweetened beverages per capita than any other country in the world, so it made sense that they did that. So do we have some really scary examples that we need to bring to the forefront to bring more urgency to this, and do we have some interesting examples of actually making more progress than we might have thought was possible? Do you have any good and bad examples for us?
Sure. In terms of global intakes of, say, sodium, for example, we've seen enormous increases in parts of Eastern Europe and Central Asia over the past several years. And this has led to really large burdens of cardiovascular diseases there. Sugar-sweetened beverage consumption is extremely high in Latin America in comparison to other parts of the world, Mexico in particular, but also many countries in the Caribbean. These are examples of where, you know, the nutrition transition has reached a very, like a pinnacle, you know, and you have these very high rates of cardiovascular disease and diabetes. Whereas in many high-income countries, especially Western high-income countries, but also Japan, the increases in healthy foods have been also slow, but they have been making progress. And even in the U.S., sugar-sweetened beverage consumption is making a slow decline. So there are examples of both the scary places where you have these huge increases in diabetes and cardiovascular disease, and also slow trends of kind of improvement.
Okay. And so for y'all listening now, we tried to email each other a little ahead of time to see if we could be on the same page and look like we were saying something cohesive. And I made a global statement and Gita disagreed. I thought that maybe the world was heading toward this homogenized Western diet. And she said, no, actually with the globalization, some of what you're seeing within countries is actually even greater disparities within a country from those with and without enough food. So can you speak to this process of globalization, maybe doing in some places more homogenization, but in some places more diversification and disparities?
Sure. So, you know, even though globally, we're seeing trends towards greater availability of ultra-processed foods and refined carbohydrates. You know, those global changes really act at a local level within countries. So depending on where a country's population is in the nutrition transition, and also depending on socioeconomic disparities within a country, those global changes can have very different impacts. So you may have increased availability of ultra-processed food and refined carbohydrates across many countries, but within countries, the transnational food companies that advertise and market these products can actually segment the market further and increase disparities between rich and poor people at different levels of education. So despite the fact that on a global scale, we think that there is a convergence towards this type of Western diet, in fact, in many countries, there's a threshold level where at a certain level of economic development, you actually see the burden of obesity shifting from the more wealthy segment of the population to the poorer. And we've seen that in our own country as well. So I think that issue of within-country divergence is also important to consider.
Thanks. All right, now Gita and I are pretty much nutrition scientists. We really focus on food. And I've had a midlife crisis that most of the work I've done in the last 20 years hasn't mattered a whack because it's really the food environment that's driving a lot of this. So I was feeling really brilliant just the last couple years thinking I'm going to expand my horizons. I'm going to be a food systems thinker. And for me, food systems is about producing food and preparing and delivering food and nudging consumers with cool messages so that they really want to eat great, unapologetically delicious, but healthy, environmentally sustainable food at the same time. And then I got a bunch of emails from Bruce, who is a systems-level thinker at Johns Hopkins, and his level of systems-level thinking kind of blows me away and out of the water. So can you give a systems-level approach? This is a systems-level problem. It's going to require systems-level thinking to make substantial differences.
Okay, thank you, Christopher. So first of all, I'd like to alleviate your midlife crisis because you and all of your body of knowledge that you've contributed are part of the system. So
okay.
You can be relieved. So one of the things that we want to emphasize is, you know, we like to think of ourselves as autonomous individuals, and you know, we can choose whatever we want. And you know, I can choose to eat healthy, and people who are either not getting enough nourishment or enough nutrition or are overweight or getting overnutrition, that's a choice. That's an individual behavior. But that's really not the case. And you know, of course, there are extreme examples in lower income countries where people can't even get access to food. But even high income countries, you know, we are influenced by the systems around us. So we choose what we eat based on what is available, what we have access to. And there are many examples, even in high income countries, where you can't readily get access to healthy food. Most of the stuff that's around you is either highly processed or sugar sweetened, et cetera. We're influenced by our social structures, you know, what people that we encounter eat, you know, our peers, our friends, our family members, et cetera. We're influenced by the media, the culture. Economics plays a very important factor. You know, what we can afford, you know, the types of jobs that we have, the types of wages that we earn, all of those determine what we eat. A lot of policy making. So basically, just everything around us really affects what we eat and what we have access to. And sort of to add some of the things that Gita was saying, we're seeing very interesting situations around the world. For example, we're seeing situations where we have a combination of undernutrition and overnutrition. We're seeing body morphologies that we haven't seen in years, or we've never seen. Kids who are stunted because they don't have enough nutrition early on, but then they tend to be more prone to gain weight as they grow older. So you're having a combination or a double burden of undernutrition and obesity. So we're really seeing just very unusual and very new changes in many different things around the world, which tells us that the systems have changed. So this is not like an individual factor. This is not like, oh, it's just the spread of X, Y, and Z. We've really seen fundamental changes in the systems that are around us and the food systems that are around us. Now, some of those changes are good in the sense that now you're seeing certain populations that didn't have access to any food get access to now some food. But the challenge is it's not just getting access to food. It's getting access to healthy food that's key. And how do people get access to healthy food? Well, one primary thing is you've got to get the food from the source, which is the farm or wherever the food is being grown or produced, ultimately to the population. And that takes a series of different steps. You basically have to go through many different locations. And nowadays, food systems have become increasingly global. So if you get something, for instance, you know, an orange or some fish, chances are that orange or that fish didn't come from your backyard. I mean, of course, unless you're a farmer, then it probably came from your backyard. But assuming that most of you are not farmers, it probably came, you know, maybe from a distant location. It could have come from another country. And then it basically has to travel. So think of the that poor orange. It has to go from the tree and then go through all these storage locations. and then maybe travel many miles and then go through different personnel, and then ultimately we'll have to reach the people. And that's a long journey and takes a long time. And as you know, a lot of healthy food is very fragile. It has to be refrigerated, it has to be treated well. It's sort of like a high maintenance person. It basically has to be treated very well, has to fly business class, all these type of things. Whereas on the flip side, if you've got processed food many times doesn't need to be refrigerated. It's very sturdy. It's very, you know, you can throw processed food into coach. You can throw it into, you know, storage and say, I can handle. Many of you probably seen the documentary Super Size Me, I guess a number of years ago, where they basically take the fast food French fries and they put it out on the counter, and I think for like several weeks or a month.
A year.
Yeah. And it basically looks exactly the same.
Yeah.
It looks great. I mean, you're like, I could eat this. Well, you probably don't want to eat it. Whereas if you put an orange or you put a piece of fruit out there, it's going to rot very quickly. So basically, this food has a competitive advantage. Processed food has a competitive advantage of getting actually to the people. So we're seeing situations where populations are getting highly processed food, but they're not getting healthy food. You can go to some of the most remotest parts of the world, and you can actually see candy wrappers and soda bottles and things like that. So that's an example of where we have a system in place that may be contributing to some of these dietary differences.
Jason, go ahead.
So can I jump in? One of the things I think is interesting is that it seems like you're getting these systems that are changing at the same time that you're getting hundreds of millions of people moving from, you know, really low levels of income to income levels where they can afford more things like that. And I'm wondering from your perspective whether right now at this moment in time we're seeing both huge numbers of people being able to afford more processed foods, more meats, more dairy products, and you're also seeing businesses ending up penetrating out into places that they never have before. I'm wondering if we're getting a confluence of systems and economic growth and poverty alleviation that are all coming together right now, sort of the beginning of the 21st century.
Absolutely. I think one of the challenges is we're seeing growth in many different sectors, and a lot of that growth is not planned. It's occurring, it's unexpected, of course. But that growth and that change affects everything. It affects the diet, affects the food available. Like you said, suddenly people have disposable income that didn't have it before. And then businesses, of course, are looking for new markets, and so they're expanding as well. So we're seeing these mismatches. The system isn't being built or developed in a way that is being planned, so we're seeing a lot of unintended consequences. You know, an example is, and I think, Jason, you might have mentioned this previously, you know, we're seeing increased urbanization. We're seeing expansion of cities in many low-income countries and middle-income countries, but there's not planning involved. So the cities grow, and then, you know, where are the food sources? Are buildings being built over farms or places where normally people would get, or the rivers where people would normally fish? Those considerations are not being part of the whole plan or design. These things are all interconnected. And if we don't step back and say, okay, what is really happening with all these different systems, then we can't find a solution. The problem is we're looking at pieces of the puzzle. All of you have probably seen that picture, that cartoon where you have the elephant and everyone's blindfolded or can't see and they're touching a different part of the elephant and they say, oh, this elephant is like a tusk or this elephant is like the tail, but no one really sees the whole elephant. That's the situation that we're dealing with. And until we actually understand these systems and address these systems that are leading to changing diet, leading to obesity, leading to undernutrition, then we're going to just be applying Band-Aids that will not be sustainable and actually will have unintended consequences. There are many examples of very well-meaning approaches where we say, okay, this will solve the problem. This will improve people's diets or this will decrease obesity. And we see the reverse and we're like, what happened? Oh, that obviously can't work. You know, so good point, Jason.
So can I bring one up that's really relevant? So dietary guidelines, supplemental nutrition assistance program, subsidies. So right here in our own country, the USDA is responsible for our dietary guidelines, and we're going to get new 2015 guidelines any day now.
Yeah.
Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee said with these new ones, we should link it to environmental sustainability. Mm-hmm. Food industry went berserk and said, that's ridiculous. That is completely out of the purview of nutrition to be talking about links to environmental sustainability. Yeah. We've got a lot of knee-jerk reactions that say we've got a farm bill that supports corn and soy subsidies that goes into ultra-processed foods. But very few people appreciate that 80% of the farm bill goes to SNAP. It's actually the food safety net that we have. Mm-hmm. And then if you dig down into the food safety net, we have data that says folks who are of income equality type levels, who do and don't take advantage of SNAP, the ones who do are more obese than the ones who don't. Mm-hmm. Partly because the additional food they're able to buy is ultra-processed and hyper-palatable. Mm-hmm. And so trying to connect the USDA, the dietary guidelines, the food assistance program, the subsidies for corn and soy, I feel like those are the elephant. Like everybody's pulling on the tail and the trunk. And so so there's got to be some urgency here where we can pull all those together. Do you, and in your work, how do you get people to talk to one another in those different parts of the system?
Yeah, a good point. You know, one of the challenges is many disciplines, many industries, many professions are very siloed. And these are artificial constructs, right? For instance, you have a discipline of sociology and economics. Well, sociology is affected by economics and vice versa. Biology is affected by sociology. So these disciplines are really interconnected. You know, all of us sort of grow up within a certain discipline, and then professionally, people tend to sort of stay within their silos. So I think that's one of the challenges. We are starting to see examples where there's an understanding that these systems interact. So a lot of major funding organizations are starting to try to bring more systems approaches to the grants they make and the RFPs they issue. We're also starting to see some in policymaking. You mentioned this issue with SNAP benefits, et cetera. So for instance, Minneapolis passed a staple foods ordinance, mm-hmm. which requires food sources like stores to carry a minimum percentage of staple foods. So these are like fruits and vegetables, healthy foods. So therefore, you're increasing the selection. You're increasing the odds or the probability that someone who walks into a store and says, okay, oh, I see all these fruits and vegetables. Maybe I'll get that instead of some packaged goods or something of that sort. And we're starting to see initiatives where you have approaches, systems approaches, like computer modeling and systems mapping to really show decision makers how things are connected. Because that's the challenge. We all have the ability to see what's right in front of us, but you go a second degree or a third degree, it gets harder. So you look at many other fields such as air traffic control or meteorology or manufacturing. They now use a lot of systems approaches, mm-hmm. like computer simulation modeling, to really show, okay, this is what's happening. I mean, think about meteorology or agriculture before you had weather maps or simulation models. It'd be basically, okay, let's see, the moon's over there, the stars over there, you know, that cow's laying down, I think it's gonna rain. You'd have the farmer's almanac, et cetera. So you can know what's happening, well, maybe in 2 hours or 3 hours, but now, you know, we take it for granted. We know, actually have an idea what the weather is like, you know, fairly far in advance. And we think it's not accurate, but it's actually very accurate compared to what we were dealing with decades ago. So bringing some of those systems approaches to diet, to food, et cetera, you know, there's a real opportunity to do this. And it will help us really understand how things fit together.
Fantastic. Okay, and I like your vision of these circles, concentric circles, and getting broader and broader. So for you guys, Gita and I are in nutrition area, and it relates to obesity, and Bruce is a systems-level thinker and is interested in the global burden of obesity. Jason is not. He is not a nutrition foodie. He is a globe-trotting investigative journalist who I read put your toe in the Pacific and the Atlantic and just traveled from one side to the other and got down and dirty. And do people care enough about food? Is this seen as an urgent issue in the face of war and Ebola and other things? What does the world think?
Food is crucial. I mean, food is just a huge part of our world. Everybody wants food every day. Where in the world people are making choices about food. And, you know, I cover global health and development. And so we just came out with the new sustainable development goals from the UN, and there's this goal to alleviate poverty by the year 2030. And what I find amazing about the stories that I do and looking at the world is that you've got this real sort of conflict going on, in that there's this effort to move as much of the world out of poverty as possible, to help people earn more money, live better. And yet, in a lot of places, I'm seeing that people aren't living better. You particularly look at the Middle East, the rates of obesity and diabetes there are just unbelievable. And that's a place that's very rich. And also you're seeing this happening in Africa as well, as in countries where incomes start to increase, you end up with all of these health consequences which are directly related to people doing well. So there's this incredible opportunity, I think, to think about development and how over the next few decades, as we try to push for more people in the world to be doing better, how are we going to avoid some of these consequences like you've seen in Mexico? I mean, I was based in Mexico City. Mexico has a huge obesity problem. And it's in a place where Mexico's economy is doing fairly well. And I think it's really interesting to start thinking about this from a systems level perspective, because usually everybody's like, oh, you know, blame the victim. It's like, you know, they're making poor choices. You know, they start to get a little bit of money and they're going to, you know, just eat terribly. And it's not always as simple as that. And I think that this is something that doesn't get enough attention when people are thinking about what kind of world do we want in the middle of the 21st century. When we get there, what kind of world do we want? And it has huge impacts in terms of the environment, from the agricultural production. It's got impacts just personally on, are people going to live decent lives? And they're not going to if they've got health burdens such as diabetes and hypertension and other issues like that because of their diet. So I think it's, you know, really great to be thinking about what can happen to shift diets towards more healthy diets that are both sustainable and are better for individuals, so people just live better.
So let me put it in this perspective. The original nutritional diseases of deficiency,
right,
with insufficient amounts of foods, pellagra, goiter, scurvy, beriberi, we don't really have those so much anymore.
Right.
So we've transitioned to the chronic disease link. And for a long time, we've always associated cancer and heart disease with this.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not going to have a heart attack or get cancer for many people for many, many years. Has obesity and diabetes just changed the name of the game here? So you can see the obesity step up, and diabetes is right on the heel of that, and it comes with amputations, it comes with blindness. And so is that the, unfortunately, are we in such bad shape that we've moved from cancer and heart disease to obesity and diabetes, and it's more in our face, and so we have a more of a hope of making a difference when people see how problematic it is?
Well, see, I think it's in people's faces in places like the Middle East, in some of the Pacific Island nations where the rates are incredibly high. I think we're still in the early stages in places like Africa, some of Southeast Asia. I don't think you're seeing it at that level yet, and I don't think the warning signs have really been raised. But I think, yes, I think you're right. We are moving in that direction, and I think... Yeah, it's definitely going to be a major issue that needs to be dealt with in the coming years.
So we had some Saudi Arabians come to our group at Stanford saying, we're in deep trouble. Diabetes is 25% in our population. And I said, let's start thinking about your heritage foods. That's part of the problem as you've moved on to this other diet. And this physician looked at me with all sincerity and said, we're not going to eat those anymore. We're rich. Wow, that's a huge stumbling block. If you're willing to have diabetes and obesity because you have more money and you want the food to taste great, but you're willing to cut off legs and go blind.
No, it's a difficult one. I mean, you look in Central America, you know, in El Salvador, Guatemala, those places, a sign of doing well is being able to go into a fast food restaurant oftentimes. It's a sign of having sort of made it. And a lot of the economic development you see in places like that is, you know, related to places where malls are popping up, and they're setting up restaurants that look just like what we have here, which end up with a lot of meat, a lot of sodium, high-calorie meals, which are not very healthy.
You're listening to World Affairs, a weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Jason Beaubien of National Public Radio, Bruce Lee of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and Geeta Singh of Tufts University. The conversation is moderated by Christopher Gardner of the Stanford Prevention Research Center. This was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs Council audience as part of our annual conference. And now back to our conversation.
So I think
Jason, you
touched an important point. Food is not just sustenance. It has very important cultural and social meaning,
yeah,
right? So where do we have our deepest conversations over food? You know, where do we have business transaction over food? Most dates involve food. you know, all these food is such a big part of what we do. And, you know, and many times, like, if you go on a bad date, it's because you went to a bad restaurant or something. So it's really hard to tell people, oh, okay, you know, you need to eat better, et cetera, because it's so ingrained in so many different systems here. And that I haven't met a single person, well, maybe I haven't met enough people, but I haven't met a single person who says, I really want to eat badly. You know, I want to eat processed foods all the time, and I just, that's what I want to do. No, it's usually because the circumstances and everything around them sort of lead to that. So we really have to address all these different systems. But.
All right, so I got a great one to tackle. It's a couple themes that come in here, and it's cost, and it's elitism and healthy food, and it costs so much. Can we address that? Because it doesn't need to. I mean, I'm going to bring up that Saudi Arabian example again. The healthiest food didn't cost as much. Now that they have more money, they want a different kind of food, and it's less healthy that costs more money. So we kind of have this myth, and part of it is because we live in the Bay Area. So you can get beautiful, technically organic food from Chile any time of the year you want, or, I mean, shipped from long places. That's why it costs so much. But if you had bulk grains and bulk beans and seasonal vegetables that weren't grown that far away, which is, I have to say, a little elitist for San Franciscans to say because we have some great weather all year, but still, frozen foods. So if you pick some of these crops frozen, they really don't lose a lot of their nutrients. They can be shipped, they can be stored. Is it really that expensive to eat well? Could we address part of it? I feel like that's a myth. And that's what a couple of these questions are. If we want them to eat healthy, it's going to cost too much. What perspectives do we have on that?
That's been one of the arguments of store owners and throughout the world. They say, well, you know, we get these foods, we have to have a refrigerator, we have to put them in the refrigerator. So we've seen many low-income neighborhoods where this is the case and say, well, you know, we can't afford a refrigerator. Or the inventory cycle has to be a lot more frequent, right? I can't keep fruits and vegetables, again, on the shelves. I have to move them, whereas the processed foods can sit there for ages. And that really changes a lot of the dynamics. But part of that is due to the sort of the economic and operational setup, because previously, you know, a long time ago, a lot of food was grown locally. And so you don't have to worry as much about inventory churn or storing things, et cetera. So the cost of healthier food is a concern in the current systems. In other words, if you have someone who is selling food, it is easier to hold more processed foods. But there's the opportunity to change systems so that that's not the case. And I already mentioned one example is a movement towards more locally grown foods, establishing things like urban farms within cities. So that can be changed.
Just to add to that, so we did an analysis a few years ago where we looked at this exact question. And in fact, we found that on average, a healthier diet versus an unhealthier diet may cost about $500 more per year, which, depending on where you are in the income spectrum, can be nothing or it can be actually quite a lot. And so, you know, considering ways of subsidizing, you know, healthier foods like fruits and vegetables, you know, may actually make them more affordable and more available to people at all levels of income.
So let me take a systems-level approach to this. So Second Harvest Food Bank is one of the largest food banks in the country. It straddles San Mateo and Santa Clara County. You guys wouldn't know this because you're not from around here. But food banks, just for very practical reasons, usually thrive on non-perishable foods, which tend to be crap. And so we're handing out crap to the people who need better quality food. They've actually now adopted a system, and it required donating a warehouse and a lot of work. 50% of what they distribute is produce now. It's staggering. Mm-hmm. But they actually don't have the data to know if 50% was the right amount. Could it be 60? Does it really need to be 40 to be viable? So for part of this, we kind of need some examples, and we need data, and we got to share it and replicate it. But how about that as a possible solution? Something like food banks not giving out so much packaged processed food simply because it's low perishability. We need a systems-level solution to be accepting food and redistributing it, right? That's more systems-level.
Absolutely. And you also touched upon another important point. We aren't necessarily measuring the right things that we should be measuring. So you raised the point, well, you don't know the impact. People aren't measuring the impact of, you know, the changes in the types of food. It sounds great when you actually see it happen. but the system is not being measured in the proper way. So we may not know, you know, what's the impact of, we don't know the full impact of obesity. We have numbers. We know the numbers are quite staggering, but in many ways those are underestimates. And the same thing with, you know, how are we being affected by these, the world's changing diet. We know qualitatively some of these changes, and we have samples here and there, but I don't think we see the whole picture. And so that's a big part of the solution, which is understanding what we need to really measure and how do we measure this over time.
I got some more here. You ready?
Yeah, go with some more.
So building on the idea of cost, is a meat-based diet, and should insect protein substitute for meat protein? That's a couple of the comments that we have in here.
Interesting.
So I have a disclosure. I have been a vegetarian for 30 years and a vegan for 5, and I am sick and tired of people asking me where I get my frigging protein, okay? I get plenty of protein. But there is an American obsession with protein, and that if we are going to, actually the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee said for 2015 we should move to a more plant-based, less animal-based diet, which of course caused an uproar in the livestock community. In fact, there was just a supplement to the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition funded by beef, pork, egg, et cetera, that said we need more protein, and it needs to be higher quality, and it needs to be meat, to which one of your colleagues, Bruce, and I wrote an incensed letter to the editors of the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition citing some FAO data that show that Americans eat approximately 175 pounds of meat a year, which is 4 times more than most countries, many countries in the world that don't have any problem with protein insufficiency or protein inadequacy. We seem to have this amazing myth that, oh my God, if we are gonna cut down on meat, oh my God, where are we gonna get that protein? I guess it'll have to be crickets. It's gonna have to be cricket flour, et cetera. Does anybody, I mean, it is true. So at another level, the insect thing is quite clever. They're actually, if we go culturally across the world.
Yeah, in Mexico, chapulines, they eat those down there.
There's a lot of options that Americans don't really consider that are viable, and yet some of these I go berserk thinking, I mean, you don't even need that, I'm sorry. Any comments on, because a meat-based diet is more expensive, a livestock-intensive food system does cost more environmental degradation. Any thoughts on that in terms of the cost? It's not just more fruits and vegetables, it's some of these other components.
Well, I don't regularly eat insects, although I bike a lot, so I probably inadvertently eat a lot of insects. So I guess several comments. So one is, we've noticed that many times when these nutritional guidelines come out, there's a focus on one thing. You know, there's always one piece of information that people tend to latch onto, and they don't look at the whole thing holistically. They'll say, oh, you know, this says, this food is good and this food is bad, or et cetera. It's more complicated than that. I mean, certainly everyone has their variations in terms of their, you know, the diets that they want and their optimal diets. This, you know, to look at that and suddenly say, okay, well, we can't get enough protein from those dietary guidelines. You know, there's many, many different sources of protein, and it's only one part of the whole picture. So that's sort of my initial reaction to that.
Okay, and now I'm reading one that's related that I didn't see before. I mean, the picture here is, if India and China go towards a meat-based diet the same way America does, I mean, the implications for agricultural activity is just staggering, because they eat far less than we do. If you look at FAO statistics, it's growing and growing and growing as they aspire to that diet, and it's going to be problematic if everybody tries to eat the way that they eat here.
And we talked about this a little bit on an email thread that we had earlier, but the world could be going from about 7 billion people now up to 11 billion by the end of the century, and you know, what is going to be the impact if the rest of the world and these extra 4 billion that get added are eating the way Americans are eating? You know, what would be the consequences of that? And trying to map that out is kind of, That was a slap in the head.
Okay,
people in the radio land, that was a slap in the head from Christopher.
Okay, diving deeper and going back to Gita. So you've done some really fascinating stuff with soda tax work. So this is a question. Is soda tax an effective, just solution to combat systemic food inequalities across the globe? And that was another one of our email threads is, you know, as nutrition scientists, we have to have an evidence base to create a policy to make a change. And it seems like sugar-sweetened beverages, there is no lower-hanging fruit than sugar-sweetened beverages. And you have done some fantastic modeling work across the globe. And yet sometimes we have a hard time getting policymakers even to be willing to. So let's take USDA and New York. Bloomberg proposed years ago that we take SNAP and not just implement this, we test it. They say, let's not let SNAP dollars go towards sodas, because that seems wrong. If it's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, they can buy sodas with their own money, but with SNAP, they should buy something else. A combination of the Hunger Coalition and the American Beverage Society shot that down, and the USDA did not allow them to collect data on the consequences of making soda offline for SNAP. And part of that, that the Hunger Coalition was against, was they thought, think of that poor kid who's in line with their EBT card now, and the cashier turns him away and says, oh, you have to get out of line and put that back. You can't buy a soda with your EBT card. There's stigma that goes with that, but isn't there stigma with being overweight too? So what do you think about soda taxes?
Yeah, that's a great and very relevant question. So I think in terms of the effectiveness of soda tax, we should really look to the experiment that's currently going on in Mexico, where they have implemented not only a 10% tax on sugar-sweetened beverages, but also an 8% tax on junk food that was recently implemented. So it would be great to see how that turns out. And I think preliminary data already suggests that, it has reduced the consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages just in the past year or so. In terms of whether it is kind of a fair thing to do, well, you really have to think about things at the population level. If we want to improve diabetes rates and cardiovascular disease rates, we have to implement these sort of population level policies. And as Bruce mentioned, we have to stop kind of blaming the individual. We have to think about the whole food environment, and things like taxes and subsidies are one way of getting at that issue by reducing consumption at a population level, as opposed to, say, just telling people, don't drink so much sodas, it's bad for you. The thing is, what's available to people, and if people can afford it and they like it, then what's going to deter them from purchasing it? So the real question is how to effectively change things at a population level, and policy is kind of the best way to do that, I think.
Can I just play the devil's advocate, however? It is interesting, though. I mean, soda is one part of the diet, and the idea that government and through taxes is going to try to micromanage what people eat seems like it could go too far. And that to really actually get people to be eating what they should be, you'd have to have all kinds of incentives or taxes. And so that soda is just this one little sliver that's being taxed. Is that ultimately what's going to get people to get toward the ideal diet?
Sure. So it is just one component of diet, and as Christopher mentioned, it is kind of a low-hanging fruit. It's a component of diet that has absolutely no nutritional value, as opposed to things like increasing fruit and vegetable intake, where you have to make large changes in food systems distribution, changes in sodium intake, where you have to improve formulation of a lot of packaged food. So, yeah, it is kind of a low-hanging fruit in that aspect. But it's an important thing to target, and it remains to be seen how effective it is. But it seems so far it is having some impact.
Bruce, go ahead.
So to respond to Jason, one thing that we have to keep in mind, the Mexico soda tax was the result of a number of different steps and a whole process to actually get the tax passed. So there was a lot of advocacy, there was a lot of education. So in some ways, it's not just a tax that accompanied this policy, but there's a whole line of different types of educational and communication strategies and programs, et cetera. I think the early data for these soda tax is showing a decrease in consumption, and it may not be just the tax that had that effect. One of the concerns with the Berkeley tax was that, okay, if you add this tax, then a lot of the manufacturers will just absorb the tax, basically just reduce the price of soda enough so that the consumers don't really see the tax. There's a group in Berkeley that's been studying this, and they've seen some price increases, but not completely to the point where the prices were at original prices plus the tax. I think in any situation, there really needs to be a whole orchestrated set of things. It is true that that potentially soda is potentially one of the low-hanging fruits. But if you just implement one intervention, chances are the system will then adapt and you will basically see the effects of the intervention mitigated.
So let me build on that this way. So yes, we have this slippery slope. First soda, then fruit juice? No, Gatorade first, then fruit juice. Okay, but still, wherever you draw the line is tough. But it's the paternalistic thing. So should government do this? You know, we've got free choice. Don't tell me how to eat. But we've got this massive societal burden that the rest of society is paying for all the healthcare problems and our economy's being crippled this way. So let me toss this out. What about menu labeling and toy bans and other things? So I know a fabulous colleague named Junjo Lee, who works for the Hartman Group, which advises the food industry. And she does some ethnographic work living in families. And her take on this is that consumers are starting to ask for, and the two words she uses are fresh and minimally processed. And that when she advises food companies, they're actually thinking of changing their lines to be ahead of the curve, because that's what the consumers are going to demand. So I feel like part of this is we're threatening paternalism and government intervention and taxes. And that may be bad. It may have a slippery slope. But isn't it raising the conversation to say, this is so bad, government has to step in. And to avert it, the food companies are going to say, no, 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 don't regulate me. We're going to change. Is that possible? Because I want to end on a positive note here, right? How positive can we be? Or am I being rose-colored glasses here?
Well, to give one example, so Chile recently has implemented a national regulation on marketing and advertising of unhealthy foods. It remains to be seen how effective this is, but that type of strategy, you know, to actually pull back on the advertising and marketing, which really, you know, draws people in at a younger age to consume unhealthy diets, receives a huge amount of pushback in most higher income countries. So this is kind of a difficult issue to get around, but if we can think of a way to do it, I think that might be a great option.
Not to go back towards something too negative, but I do think that one of the huge issues in the developing world is that you could end up with diets changing to being incredibly unhealthy at economies that have just barely gotten above sort of poverty level, so you don't have healthcare infrastructure like they have in Saudi Arabia to deal with it. So I see that from a global perspective as a real danger out there, that diets are going to change in a way that end up burdening healthcare systems in some of these countries, pushing down economic growth, and that it could end up being a real spiral downwards for some countries if they don't come around and see that this is a crucial issue for their economic growth, for their development down the road, particularly for the countries that haven't jumped up like China or like India is doing, but countries, you know, in Africa and some other countries where they don't have the healthcare infrastructure to deal with some of the problems that their diet is going to cause a few years down the road.
So can you follow up on that? So are you suggesting there's more room for government intervention?
Well, I'm not saying what the answer is, but I think that being...
You can't just give me that problem. You've got to give me the answer, too. Come on.
But I think that being more aware of it and looking at what Bruce has been talking about in terms of some of the systems and at times possibly not allowing some companies to come in and make it such that... I mean, you can get a Coke anywhere on this planet, in any corner of the Earth, as well as, like, processed crackers and, like, sweetened, you know, there's one with, like, the cream in the middle. I mean, you can get those anywhere. And if sort of systems are allowed to develop that is what gets penetrated out into these countries, I think it's going to be problematic.
I want to shift the dialogue a bit, because we talk about governments as paternalistic or regulatory. What about the flip side? So there are many examples throughout the history where governments are catalytic. So we think in the long run, governments have been catalytic. You know, the basis of science is catalyzed by NIH and NSF. The internet started off as a government project, and now we're seeing, you know, we wouldn't see, you know, the dot-com boom or the social media boom without the groundwork that was laid for the internet, and that started off as a government project. Bill Gates likes to use the term creative capitalism. In his words, he feels that capitalism works when you basically have businesses meeting the needs of the population. So, like, for instance, if people want bananas and I'm selling hammers, I'm not going to make money unless I throw the hammers and say, you will take these hammers. So then I will make money if I sell bananas. So I want to toss out the possibility of potentially innovative mechanisms that governments can use to align incentives, to say, okay, you know, this, here are the incentives to produce healthy foods, to make these foods more available to the population. I think there are potentially some big business opportunities out there. And I think one of the challenges is there has been this more antagonistic dialogue saying that, okay, well, you know, stop doing this. Oh, no, we don't want to stop doing this. It's not really that. I mean, you can change product lines. You can have opportunities. There are examples of businesses that have been very successful selling very healthy foods and healthy products. And potentially we can see many more of those. So I'm very optimistic about the future because I think that we have seen many examples in public health where we've seen governments and major organizations play very catalytic roles. And maybe if we move towards that and move the dialogue towards that, we can really find sort of a win-win situation.
I love that. So let me build on that with some CDC guidelines for procurement. Mm-hmm. So actually, I served on the American Heart Association's Nutrition Committee for a while, and usually we talk about saturated fat and omega-3s and things like that. And somebody said, we need a policy statement on federal procurement guidelines. I said, what? And they said, no, that's really what we want. And so we did a search, and the American Heart has a set of guidelines, and really interesting, the CDC has a set of guidelines that came out in 2012. And there's a fantastic guy named Joel Kimmons from UC Davis, who's at the CDC, who got in a whole bunch of sustainability guidelines at standard and even above standard. And in this document, it talks about shade-grown, bird-friendly, pasture-raised. Now, Guy, we know we don't have any data on that. There is no way I know if bird-friendly will save a heart attack 50 years from now, right?
Unfortunately, not yet.
But there are enough data to suggest that there is this strong link in environmental sustainability, et cetera. So to build on Bruce's point, as a catalytic agent, it is now mandatory that all federal cafeterias follow these guidelines. And so think about the impact economically this has, mm-hmm. that you have to follow the guidelines. Now you're supporting the production and preparation of healthier foods to serve the people in the cafeterias that work for the federal government. And now maybe by supporting those local farms, because they have to access it, and maybe there wasn't enough demand before, mm-hmm. now you've increased the demand. Now you've done that for universities. Now you've done it for hospitals. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God, you might have changed social norms as mm-hmm. you start to do this, right? So mm-hmm. I like your idea of the government actually being a catalytic force for progress here.
Hey, Christopher, you're claiming that you're not a systems thinker, but that was systems thinking right there. So,
yes! Excellent. I will say I got to do a little self-plug of what's happening to us later this mm-hmm. week. So on October 26th and 27th, 24 universities are going to come to the Stanford campus. They're bringing dining service and faculty. Mm-hmm. And the idea is to use our university campuses as living laboratories and to focus on changing the way we procure food, changing the way the culinary staff treats it, and nudging all the students who are young adults who will then have habits for the next bazillion meals of their lives. Because you have to source good food. And then you have to get the chefs who prepare it to buy in. We're doing a really fun project with Google right now. Sorry to sound elitist. I'm sure that sounds horrible. But so much of our food is prepared these days. If you see the data that they have from the Hartman Group, 50% of the food we get is prepared. Because you can not only go to a restaurant and get prepared food, you can go to a grocery store and get all kinds of prepared food, right? And so we want convenience. We do this. Well, if the chefs are preparing all this food, the Culinary Institute of America has taken on a mission of teaching its chef, training its chefs to cook more healthfully and with more environmental sustainability. And we want to take that to universities and work with chefs on the Google campus and the Stanford campus. We're doing a sodium reduction thing. And instead of saying there's a guideline and you need to get below this, we're saying, hey, what's your day like? I bet your day is really tough. You got to serve all these folks and get all these meals out. And if they don't like your meals, they're mad at you and you want to feel good at the end of the day. So let's not talk about sodium reduction. Let's talk about building flavor profiles. How many ways do you build flavor profiles and take advantage of your training, your culinary training? So I think there's some really fascinating things going on in our country right now at work sites, at hospitals, at universities, where we could be changing social norms if we're shifting at multiple levels the way we think about this food. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts or examples you guys have of things like that? I think I know Tufts and Harvard are doing great things, and Johns Hopkins has the Center for Livable Future that Bob Lawrence runs. Mm-hmm. Ah, there's some great things going on, to be optimistic. Yes?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Other examples? Anybody?
Yeah.
I don't want you to put you on the spot, but okay. I am. I'm putting you on the spot.
You mean examples of...
Something happening at your university, mm-hmm. you know, some of these catalytic things the government is doing, the CDC or your university.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there are several examples. So in Baltimore, we have a large project that's run by Joel Gillison, which is a multi-level community intervention project to improve the food environment for many of the Baltimore low-income neighborhoods, which have been classified as food deserts. So food deserts are places which have low access to healthy foods. And we worked with Bob Lawrence's Center for Livable Future to identify these food deserts. And then Joel and his team has gone in, and they've been doing many different types of interventions. So again, combination systems interventions, not a single intervention. But these range from cooking classes to peer mentoring groups to working with store owners to try to improve their stocking patterns to different types of education programs to working with suppliers and working with the city government and many of the stakeholders. There's a Baltimore Policy Working Group that they have formed that includes people from the mayor's office, from the city council member's office, from all the different stakeholders, where they discuss together, you know, how do we address this food environment issue? And you really see situations where you are getting the different stakeholders on board. They understand, okay, yeah, if we at the same time increase demand for healthy foods, and then we increase supply at the same time, then that satisfies the store owner's need to maintain profits and maintain viability. If you did one without the other, you might have problems. But these are situations where everyone is happy. You know, the population realizes, okay, well, you know, we can, you know, the kids can start cooking. The store owners are still making profits. So that's one example of sort of a systems level approach where you really see all the different stakeholders getting what they are interested in getting.
I think from a development perspective and from sort of the global aid world, there's more of an effort now to not just be sending bags of U.S. corn or rice in when there's a disaster. There's much more of an effort and a recognition that it does more to help, say, you know, the Philippines after Typhoon Haiyan to actually source a lot of that relief food locally. And so I think there's a recognition there. And I think that also is another place where systems are changing to realize that it doesn't really help as much if we just plow in all of American-grown food and just ship it into these places.
Yeah, I have to say, I'm ending up pretty optimistic here. So, what a fabulous team. So I hope you enjoyed this morning's conversation.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Featured in this episode about the health risks associated with changing diets are Jason Beaubien of National Public Radio, Bruce Lee of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and Geeta Singh of Tufts University. The conversation was moderated by Christopher Gardner, Director of Nutrition Studies at the Stanford Prevention Research Center. The World Affairs Council is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org to watch videos of our broadcasts, to register for an upcoming event, or to become a council member. This program is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producer Circle. Our recording engineer is Robert Zimmerman. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.